afternoon, and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are live from 2 to 3 in the afternoon, Pacific Standard Time. And if you are listening to the live program, a little later you'll be able to call in. I say a little later because our lines are at the moment full. We can't accommodate any more calls right now. But I will be talking to some of these callers, and then they will be moving along, and we'll have lines open for you. If you want to write down this number, if you have a question about the Bible, or about Christianity, or you have a difference of opinion from the host and just want to balance comment or perhaps a debate, you're welcome to do that here. We're not afraid of debate on this program. And if you want to, present an alternate view to our audience, you're welcome to do that here. We're not threatened by that at all. The number to call would be 1-800-438-5090. That is 1-800-438-5090. Right now the lines are full, but we will be talking to some callers, and then we'll have some lines opening up. Our first caller is Homer from Brownsville, Oregon. Homer, welcome to the Narrow Path. Good to hear from you again.
You too, Steve. How are you doing?
All right.
One question. When you come to Menville, some of us were talking about possibly coming up there.
Uh-huh.
Your subject on the acceptable worship of God.
Yes.
Is that going to be as in Romans 1? Or 12:1, or is it about worshiping
the
church, or what?
It's about the whole biblical topic, so it includes what's talked about in Romans 12:1. It's going to be part two, but I will summarize what I said in part one because it's been several months since I was up there. I intended to give an entire teaching on it last time I was in McMinnville, and I really only got through about half of what I wanted to say. So what I will do on this coming, not this coming Friday, but whenever it is, I'm coming up there on the 20, whatever date it is, I will be summarizing and bringing the people up to date on what I said last time and then moving on and finishing out the topic. It will be it'll be thorough. Yeah, of course, we cannot talk about acceptable worship without talking about Romans 12:1.
Right. And it would be something of interest to people who are leading worship in church.
Yes, actually, it is. These lectures are a summary of a worship seminar that I taught at a Calvary Chapel in Santa Cruz many years ago.
All right.
And it was, the worship seminar was attended by people who were worship leaders and others. So the material would be, I think, suited for worship leaders.
All right. I don't know if you'd call it a question or not, but I had something I wanted to share with you on the view of hair in 1 Corinthians 11.
Uh-huh. And long hair, short hair.
Yeah, it's often seen as about women in particular, but it seems to me from what I've been able to gather studying the subject that it's about men at least as much as about women. And
okay.
I was reading in, I've got an interesting book, it's called The Cultural Dictionary of the Bible by John Pilch, and he has an article in there on hair, and he talks about the, one thing he says in 1 Corinthians 11:14-15, where Paul talks about it being the,
a shame for a man to have long hair, but a glory to a woman.
Nature.
Mm-hmm. Or nature itself teaches it's a shame for a man to have long hair. Yeah.
Right. Pilch says the word nature should be understood as custom. And he traces the custom of wearing hair short in men, back, I think, 4 centuries before the time of Christ and so forth. But anyway, then he quotes Philo about how horrible it was for men to have long and stylized hair. And Philo, he raised about it that they should be put to death, and it was seen as a sign of homosexuality.
Well, that's why Philo would argue for their being put to death, because as a Jewish guy, he would say that the law requires that homosexuals be put to death, and that a man who wore long hair was violating what Deuteronomy says about a man shall not wear that which pertains to a woman, and a woman shall not wear that which pertains to a man.
Right.
That's where Philo would be coming from on that.
Right. And I think that's the heart of the issue is gender distinction. And I think that's the point Pilch takes in this article here. But I know you've mentioned the thing about Paul and his Nazarite vow.
Mm-hmm.
And he comments on that, and he said that Paul's Nazarite vow was a temporary one, and his hair wouldn't have grown any significant length during that time, that human hair grows 5 inches a year. And Paul's vow could have been as short as 1 month. You know, they
well, that was the minimum amount for a Nazarite vow. That's true. But certainly that argument is not very strong, because we don't know how long Paul's hair got. We don't know how long he took the vow for. He might have had it for the whole time he was in Corinth, which was 18 months, making his hair 7 inches long, or longer if his hair grew faster. But the thing is that there were, of course, people like John the Baptist and Samson and Samuel who had lifelong Nazarite vows. So whether Paul's was lifelong, or of course his was not lifelong because he shaved his head at Centuria, but whether Paul's was long enough to cause his hair to grow long,
mm-hmm.
or not, still the Nazarite vow is that which, in some people's cases, some godly people's cases, it was a lifelong abstaining from cutting the hair. So I don't. See, here's where I stand about it. I would agree that Paul's concern in 1 Corinthians 11, when he talks about nature teaches us it's a shame for a man to have long hair and that it's a glory for a woman to have long hair, I think what he's saying is that human nature, I don't think he's talking about custom there. He does use the word custom earlier and later. Well, in verse 16 he used the word custom. We have no such custom. But when he says, does not nature itself teach you, I think what he's talking about is human nature. Our own instincts tell us that for a man to dress like a woman is shameful, and for a woman to dress like a man is shameful. Now, in our society, of course, that's being changed not so much by the change in hair customs, but by the fact that a lot of movies feature, comedies feature men dressed up like women and things like that. And you know, a lot of comedians like to dress like women because it gets a big laugh, but, I think because of that, there are many who whose sensitivities are not thoroughly what they should be on that matter. Are you still there, Homer? It sounds like we got cut off. And now I need to know if we're also cut off from the radio station or just cut off from Homer. Let me hang up on Homer and see if I can take another call and see what happens there. Let's talk to Tom from Monterey. Tom, are you there? Okay, we have a problem. Houston, we have a problem. We do not have a connection. I'm going to have to reconnect. I don't know what happened there, but I'll be right back. Are we connected now? I need to know from my call screener. All right, I am informed that I'm still coming over the air, although there's been some kind of disconnect here. And I'll just go continue to talk to Homer about his question. Homer's still online here, I think. I don't know if I have any connection with Homer here. Homer, do we have you again? I don't know if our listeners can hear you. I have a problem, and the studio is trying to solve it. If you can hear me, I will continue to talk, and maybe we'll get something worked out here. I believe that Paul's concern is that men should not wear female styles and that females should not wear men's styles. However, I would add this caveat. Men's styles and female styles are not uniform from one place to another. I'm not not sure why we have this problem here, but I was hearing that. So I actually heard someone. I'm assuming, therefore, that I'm connected with the switchboard again. Maybe, maybe not. We've lost some of our callers here. I think we have some problems at the switchboard. I'm not sure. But let me say that, and this is a bit distracting, of course, so let me get back on subject here. Long hair on men, I think, was, or I should put it this way, long hair was a feminine style in Greece, and short hair was a men's style in Greece. And therefore, if a man in that culture would wear long hair, he was donning a feminine style, and therefore doing that which was an abomination. Now, some people would apply that to today and say, well, long hair is a woman's style. Well, not necessarily. In our culture, some women don't wear their hair long, and some men do wear their hair long. If a man wears his hair long today, he is not proclaiming himself to be feminine. He is simply opting for one of many styles that are neither considered feminine nor masculine in our society. We have many unisex styles. And therefore, I don't think it'd be the same issue as it was with the long hair in Corinth on men or short hair on women. I believe that in Corinth, if a woman shaved her head, she was taking on the style of a prostitute. And if she wore short hair, it was like the style of a man. And this was something that was not acceptable. But today, if a man or a woman wears long hair, short hair, or a shaved head, it doesn't seem to have specific gender associations. And therefore, I don't believe that it would have the same meaning, the same significance. I do think, though, that there still are some styles that are female styles in our culture. And I think it would be just as wrong for men to wear those female styles in our culture as it was for a man to wear long hair in Corinth, because it's the question of gender distinction that is the issue. I don't think the customs are expected to be the same in all cultures, as I point out that Paul's culture would not consider it a shame for a man to have long hair if he took a Nazirite vow. But Paul, that was not a Greek culture like Corinth had. So that's what I think about those things. I'm going to try to reconnect Homer here and see if I can talk to him again. Okay, Homer, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, good. We're connected again. Something happened and I lost you. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just heard what you said, and I think we're basically in agreement, because what I've been maintaining for some time is that the issue is not about the hair per se, but the issue is about gender distinction.
You may not know, but I wrote two magazine articles, a series of two articles on this very thing, and they're both posted at the website. Actually, they're combined into one lengthy document at the website, at thenarrowpath.com.
Uh-huh.
There's a category that says topical articles, and one of them is called something like Should Women Be Veiled or something like that.
Right. But see, now this would fit in with the Old Testament, too, because there was a big issue there in the law of gender distinction.
But again, in the Old Testament, a man or a woman could, according to Numbers 6, a man or a woman could take a Nazirite vow. Now, if a man took it, of course his hair would at some point be long. And if a woman took it, her head at one point would be shaved.
Mm-hmm.
Because a man, you know, so to say it's a shame for a man to have long hair and a shame for a woman to have a shaved head may have been true in the Greek culture, but it would not universally be true in the Jewish culture.
Right.
And even the matter of a man praying or prophesying with his head covered is a shame in Greece. It was not so in the Old Testament, because the priests had to wear a turban. There was actually a hat they had to wear while they went in and worshipped and offered incense. So the customs of Corinth would not have been the universal customs of the Jews and of everyone else, necessarily.
But in the Old Testament times, the big issue was cross-dressing or wearing effeminate clothes, wasn't it?
I think so. I think it's just the same. Basically, I think it's being a transvestite that is at issue here.
So the issue is the same, the gender distinction, but the custom that expresses that is different.
Well, right. You know Homer very well, and I don't know if you're of this opinion, but I know you probably remember people who are, if you're not, when women began wearing pants.
Right.
In our society, many people said, oh, that's not appropriate, that's a man's style. Well, actually, it was a man's style, and it probably was a rebellious act on the part of women. But today it's not a man's style. I mean, a woman who wears pants today is not rebelling against her femininity. There's many, many styles of pants that are strictly female, and no man would wear them unless he's a transvestite, you know. So, I mean, the thing is, styles do change. The real issue is a person rebelling against his own gender or her own gender by adopting a look and a style and no doubt a behavior that that is contrary to their own natural gender?
Right. That's something Pilch points out in the book. He said the gender distinctions in that age were very rigid.
Uh-huh.
You know, so, and I can remember, you probably, I don't know if you can or not, I think when women first started wearing jeans, I don't think there were any women's jeans.
You're probably right. I mean, I don't know when women first started wearing jeans. They probably wore them on farms for decades and decades. But I know that in the hippie movement, it became very popular in the 60s to wear jeans and coveralls. Yeah.
I'll let you go.
God bless you, Homer. Good talking to you.
You too.
Okay, bye now. I have to say that Tom from Monterey was one of our callers that somehow got dropped from our lines earlier when we were having technical problems. So, Tom, we have one line open for you. If you want to grab it, I'd be glad to talk to you. We're going to talk next to Chris from Boise, Idaho. Chris, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
I appreciate you taking my call, Steve. I was wondering if you can help explain the passage of Scripture that says those who rule well are worthy of double honor, I believe.
Yeah, 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse number I'll have to look up.
Okay. I don't know. If you can explain it, if it's in reference to, I heard a pastor say that it's the double honor means that he's worthy of financial support. I don't know.
I agree. But that's you've probably heard me say that I don't believe in salaried ministry. And so you wonder whether this is agreeable with that. I'll tell you how I stand on it. The verse is 1 Timothy 5:17. Let the elders who rule well be counted worthy of double honor, especially those who labor in the word and in doctrine. Because he goes on to say, for the scripture says, you shall not muzzle an ox while it treads out the grain, and the laborer is worthy of his wages. So it's clear that Paul is referring to a person laboring in ministry should not be muzzled. They are worthy of their wages. They should be accounted worthy of double honor. Now the word honor there, as some people have said, is like the word honorarium. Receiving some pay. And we know that Paul is using the word that way in the chapter because earlier in the chapter he talks about widows being supported by the church if they don't have anyone else to support them. And he uses this word honor there in chapter 5, verse 3. He says, honor widows who are really widows. But if any widow has children or grandchildren, let them first learn to show piety at home and repay their parents, and says that the church might not be burdened. So, honoring the widows means supporting the widows if they have no one else to support them. And then he says, and honor those who are elders who rule well, especially those who labor in the word and doctrine. So in both cases, he's talking about financial support. And I want to make very clear, when I say I don't believe in taking a salary for the ministry, that doesn't mean I don't believe in being supported in the ministry. As a matter of fact, for over 30 years, I have personally been supported in the ministry, but I've never been salaried. And this is the difference. Some people say, what's the difference? It's just playing with words. Not at all. A salary is paid by an organization. Usually, it's a set amount, and it's an agreed-on amount. It's a contractual arrangement between a worker and an employer. Okay? So if a man is salaried, it means he has agreed to work for a certain organization, a church or whatever, in the case of a minister, or another Christian organization. He's agreed to work, and he's agreed to do it for a certain amount of pay. And therefore, he is, in a sense, an employee of an organization. Now,
right.
I want to say this, that a man who is doing that, and certainly most pastors and most people who run Christian organizations are receiving a salary, many of them would continue to serve God even if they weren't receiving a salary. So I'm not trying to raise any issues about their motives or being mercenaries or anything like that. I believe there's many salaried ministers who would gladly serve God even if no one would pay them a salary. But it's simply the matter of defining a relationship between a minister and an organization saying, I will work for so much money. It may be that he'd be willing to work without that money, but the agreement still is this. I do these duties, and you pay me this amount of money. And to my mind, that is difficult to justify, and I'm not personally critical of ministers who are in this position. I'm just, as a purist, trying to find out what the policies of Scripture would be if the church followed them. I don't believe that a salaried ministry is what is conceived of in Scripture. I don't think that Jesus was paid a salary by any organization. I don't think Paul was paid a salary by any organization. And I don't believe any of the early ministers were paid a salary by an organization. But the Bible says many times that ministers should be supported. Now, what's the difference between being salaried and supported? Well, the difference, I would say, is this. I myself am a supported minister. And that simply means I don't have a real job. You know, I just minister full time in various ways and go places and minister and teach and so forth. That's all I do. And my bills are paid because God supports me. Now, that support does come from human beings. It comes from checks in the mail. It comes from honorariums I get when I teach and so forth. But the difference is this. When I am ministering, I am not working for an organization. I'm not even working for men at all. I'm working for God. Now, this may sound like just a pious thing to say, but in my mind, it is entirely accurate. My only employer is God. And when Paul says the laborer is worthy of his wages, well, the laborer who's working for God, it's God who pays him wages. And as you may know, if you've heard me enough, I don't have any guaranteed income from any source. There are very generous people who send me money, but no one has promised to. No one has said, okay, you know, you can count on this amount of money every month. And I wouldn't want them to, because I'm working for God. You see, when I go teach for YWAM for a week, they usually give me an honorarium of some amount. It's not huge. In fact, it's less than I would make if I was working at a job, even minimum wage probably. But the thing is, it might look like I'm working for money there. I'm going, I teach for a week, and they give me some money at the end of the week, usually. But the difference is, I have not contracted to work for money. And if they give me no money, it's all the same to me. Because I'm not working for YWAM, I'm working for Jesus. And if YWAM doesn't give me any money, then Jesus will provide my needs some other way. And that's how it's always been. I actually went to a YWAM school once in Hawaii. I taught for a whole week, gave a week of my life, taught 15 hours altogether in the week. At the end of the week, they had no money to give me. They gave me a YWAM t-shirt and a coffee mug. And that was not what I had come to expect. My experience in YWAM was that, you know, usually there's some kind of honorarium. And at first I was somewhat disappointed, of course, to receive only a t-shirt and a coffee mug rather than something I could really use, like money. But instantly, I mean, as soon as I was disappointed, I realized this is a wonderful test of my motives. Because I always say, I'm not working for YWAM, I'm working for God. And if that's true, YWAM doesn't owe me anything when I teach there. God owes me my support, if anyone does. I mean, I'm his servant. The master supplies for his servants. So my policy is, if someone asks me to teach, I go, and I teach. If I'm free, I go do it. I consider that's God opening a door for me to minister. I do not ask for money. Sometimes there's a box in the back. People can put money in if they want, but I don't charge anything. And sometimes there's not even a box there. I just go to serve God, and then God provides the money. And he's done this for me for like 30 years and more. So this is different than salary. And some people might say it's nitpicking difference. But the difference is this. I am not working for an organization or even for people. I believe that a minister is a servant of God, and therefore he should just serve God. He may do it as a pastor of a church. He may do it as the director of a Christian organization, but he should do it for God, not counting on the organization or the church to be his support, but God to be his support. Now, this may sound very idealistic, and if I hadn't done it for over 30 years, I might wonder whether it was too idealistic, but it works. It works. George Mueller did it. Hudson Taylor did it, Reese Howells did it, and yeah. I'm sure hundreds, if not thousands, of other Christian ministers have done it, and I've done it. And so I know it works. I know that God is real, and if a minister believes that God is real, then that minister should I think, be able to believe that if he served without guaranteed income, that God, who is his employer, will make sure that all his bills are paid.
Well, I appreciate... Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Yeah, I kind of lean towards your understanding of that, too. I've listened to some of your audios on that, and I appreciate your comments. It's been a while since I listened to those audios. I was just wondering if you could comment on the word rule, and I'll just go ahead and hang up and listen to the rest over the radio.
Okay. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you.
Good talking to you. Yeah. Well, it says the elders who rule well. I think rule is not a good translation. I believe that the Greek word there is better translated lead, the elders who lead well. I would actually have to look it up. I can't guarantee it, but I do know this, that in Hebrews, when it talks about those who rule over you in the church, I know the word that is used there is lead, and that rule is a bad translation. And I think that same word is used here. I just don't have my Greek text in front of me. So I don't believe that the elders are rulers over people. Jesus said the rulers of the Gentiles exercise authority over them, but it shall not be so among you. Among you, he that would be chief must be the slave of all. So I don't believe that God gives rulers to the church. I believe he gives leaders. And what's the difference between a ruler and a leader? Well, obviously, a ruler is a boss. A ruler is somebody that a person has to obey by definition. They're the ruler. A leader is someone who does the right thing, provides leadership, provides counsel and guidance, provides a good example, and is someone that others can be inspired by and can follow. The people are not required to follow him, but if they are wise, they look for people like that to follow. Okay? So, you see, my whole idea about church politics is radically different than most, too, because I don't believe that churches are supposed to be corporations run by a CEO and a board of directors. I believe churches are supposed to be families. It's a church is a family. And the leaders of the church, I don't think, are supposed to be political leaders of the organization. I think they're supposed to be spiritual leaders. And the difference is not just one of semantics. A political leader has a defined authority that other people are required to obey. A spiritual leader is simply a spiritual man who goes ahead. And others who want to be spiritual take his example and follow it. And, he can provide teaching, he can provide counsel, but most of all, he provides an example. And that is what I consider to be normative. Once again, I don't even think the apostles had a political leadership in the early church, though they, if anyone did, they did. I mean, if anyone had political power in the early church, it was the apostles. But Paul's attitude about that is expressed, for example, when he writes to the Corinthians in 2 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 24, he says, not that we have dominion over your faith, but we are fellow workers for your joy, for by faith you stand. So here's an apostle. If anyone in the first century had what we could call anything resembling political authority over the church, the apostles did. And Paul said, we don't have dominion over your faith. That you stand by before God by your own faith. We're here just to help. We're here to help you with your joy, to make your life more joyful and give you some guidance and some help along that line. So that's the attitude of a spiritual leader. I'm not here to be your boss. I'm just here to help you. I'm here to be your servant. And that's, I think, what the early church considered to be normative. And I think Paul did when he says that the elders who lead well, especially those who labor in the word and in doctrine, should be counted worthy of double honor. I don't think that means they should be paid twice as much as other people. In fact, again, I don't even think it should mean that they are paid. I think it means they should be supported, and people should be doubly, careful to make sure that those men are supported, because the church doesn't have very many of them. And if these guys starve to death, or if they have to go back into the workplace and can't serve the church as they do, the church will be the poorer for it. So that's what I think Paul has in mind there. I hope that's helpful, Chris. I know that a lot of people listening would have a different view, perhaps most people in church leadership. And I have been in church leadership. I've been an elder in a couple of different churches for usually a couple of years each time before I left. that position. I don't enjoy being in church leadership, but I do admire those who do take that burden. Being a pastor of a church or a good elder of a church who's doing what he should be doing is a very burdensome thing, and I truly appreciate men who take that task upon themselves. I don't want it. And when I go to a church and listen to a pastor preach, I always put something in the offering. If that man was not salaried, I would send him money personally. And I got a feeling some pastors would probably get more income if they just did that. If they didn't have a salary, you'd be surprised. I mean, in my own case, I can go many days without seeing any money come my way. On the other hand, on a given day, I can get more money in the mail than I would expect to earn in a week. So, I mean, it's just totally unpredictable, but I don't worry about it. I've just never worried about my finances because I felt it's not my problem. It's God's problem. The master takes care of his servants. And so if I serve him, I figure he'll take care of everything. And he always has. And that's been for many decades now. And I'm glad to testify to it because it's a good testimony to the faithfulness of God. Let's talk to Sam from Bolivar. Or is it Bolivar, Missouri? Is that where we're talking about?
Yes. People who live here call it Bolivar. But I think it was a Frenchman's name, so it is actually...
Bolivar. Okay. Missouri, right?
Yes, Missouri.
Good to hear from you, Sam.
Thank you, Steve. I just had a quick question and a little bit longer question, but they're actually both fairly quick. One is the astrology teaching. I only found the first tape at the end of it.
Oh, boy. Yeah, I don't know what to say about that. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. I was just wondering, do you know where I would find the other half of that?
All I know is that when I taught that lecture on astrology, there were two tapes. When you go to my website, was it my website or is it on Digital Ministries that you find that subject?
Digital Ministries as well.
Okay, yeah. Tom, a man named Tom in Idaho, runs that site, digitalministries.us, and he had a lot of my old tapes, many of which I did not have posted on my website. He's a friend of mine, and I gave him a bunch of old tapes, and he has gone to the trouble of digitizing hundreds of them and putting them on his website. So, of course, you've got a lot of my lectures on his website that aren't even on my own website. But I don't know what happened to that. The astrology lecture was two tapes. Perhaps the second tape broke or something. I mean, they were old cassette tapes at one time. So maybe he just doesn't have it.
That's cool. I watched a video online. I was posting in a blog or something, and somebody posted this video about, like, I forget what it's called, like Zeitgeist or something. And it was basically trying to prove that Christianity was just a spinoff of an old astrology belief, basically. You know, the whole, I don't know how to explain it, but in a way I was just like, you know, if you can put it before Christianity, somehow that seems to lessen the blow of Christianity, like, you know, Horus or whatever, the Egyptian Horus.
Mm-hmm.
And then all that other stuff. It seemed to me that was a huge blow. But when I was listening to your Psalm series, you got to Psalm 19, and everything you were saying, you explained a lot there. Even though I didn't know what to say, I had faith. Of course, my faith is strong, so that didn't destroy it. But it just really bugged me that they were able to.
Well, you're right. You're right. My lecture on Psalm 19, I go into that same subject of the astrology thing because the Psalm begins, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows forth his handiwork." And, many of our listeners, of course, are not familiar with what I say about that, but I believe there is a case that can be made, and it's been made by many evangelical teachers, and I think it seems valid, that when God put the stars in the heavens, he created constellations, which were, I think, probably Adam was informed about these constellations and their meaning. And almost all societies, since the beginning of time, have recognized these constellations. And if you follow the 12 houses of the zodiac from the beginning of Virgo all around the circle to Leo, the lion, it does very possibly, many say, it actually tells the story of the gospel, that God wrote the gospel in the sky. And even the book of Job mentions the 12 houses of the zodiac. The Hebrew word for the 12 signs is called the Maseroth. And God says to Job, you know, can you bring out the signs of the Maseroth? So God recognizes there's 12 houses of the zodiac, and all cultures recognize that. And it's very possible that that knowledge that all cultures have goes back to Adam, that Adam was the first to know it. So anyway, the idea would be that the gospel may very well have been preached in the sky from the earliest times, and therefore when you find that certain pagan religions before Christianity had some of the ideas that Christianity teaches, they may have gotten it from there.
It was awesome when I heard it, and it rang true, and then I realized, you know, to me it was just like, you know, so basically it's like the pagans say, if you talk to them, they generally say, well, paganism was around before Christianity.
Yeah.
Well, that's not an argument, really, but okay.
Yeah, prostitution was around before rocket science, too, but it doesn't make it more legitimate.
Yeah. So but that was interesting to be able to actually place that actually before paganism, if that's true about Nimrod and everything. It was really interesting. It really boosted me up. It kind of killed that for me.
Killed that doubt that was there, huh? Well, that's good. I'm glad when our teachers can do that.
But I guess the other question, which actually may wind up being shorter now, was is there a place in history as far as proven about Mariology, when it started, when they started pushing that issue? Is there a marked place in history, or is that just something that we know by tradition?
Now, are you talking about the Roman Catholic doctrines of Mariology, or are you talking about Mariolatry, which would be the idolization of Mary?
Oh, well, I would assume that it was both of them.
Well, they're related. They are related. I mean, the Roman Catholics would say they don't idolize Mary, but they do have certain doctrines they have come up with through tradition about Mary that give her a rather, you know, a much more special place in their eyes than what the Bible itself would justify. But they would say they don't worship Mary. Now, Protestants, looking on at the way that some Catholics venerate Mary, would say, well, it looks like worship to me. And so the worship of Mary would be Mariolatry, like idolatry of Mary. But Mariology, or the Marian doctrines, as they could be called, are simply traditional doctrines the Roman Catholic Church developed about Mary in the centuries since the Apostles' time. Now, you're wondering where they arose?
Yeah, was that like a council held in like the 300s, similar to,
Well, the Marian doctrines were not all adopted at one time. And I don't think any of them were present at the Nicene Council, which the Nicene Council in 325 AD was the first of the ecumenical councils. There were many, many others after that, and I don't remember the names and the dates of all of them, but a number of the later councils came up with some of the Marian doctrines, but usually I think one or two at a time. There's quite a few Marian doctrines the Roman Catholic Church accepts, and they weren't all adopted at one time. The idea that Mary herself was sinless is one of the Marian doctrines. The idea that she was the product of an immaculate conception. Now, when people hear the word immaculate conception, they often confuse it with the virgin birth of Jesus. But it's a different doctrine. The virgin birth means that Mary was a virgin when she be conceived. But the Catholic doctrine of the immaculate conception is about how Mary herself was conceived in her mother's womb. It's not the virgin birth of Christ. The immaculate conception is that when Mary's parents had sex and she was conceived, that a supernatural act was done by God that prevented the sinful nature of her father from being transmitted to her, so that she was born free from that and she is sinless. That immaculate conception of Mary is a Marian doctrine that came up hundreds of years after the time of the New Testament. The idea that Mary is the co-redemptrix, that is, she's involved also in the redemption of humanity along with Jesus. The idea that Mary did not die but ascended into heaven, these are some of the doctrines that have come along.
Right, okay. And I guess they would be working off of logic after that then, right? Just, I mean, because she was without sin, then she wouldn't die, so something had to happen to her, so she probably ascended her. I mean, do you think that's the way it more or less was hammered out, or do you think that was there any...
Well, I really can't say. Not having been in on those discussions, I really wonder sometimes what motivated these councils to come up with these doctrines. But, yeah, one could say that, you know, once you've come up with one of them, some of the others might seem to follow naturally afterwards.
I see. I just wonder, you know, all the things that I can find. I think, Mark chapter either 3 or 6 or something, where it talks about, you know, who are my brothers and my sisters. And he was, you know, it seemed, especially when Jesus, his brothers were referred to being brothers, what is it, Anadelphus or something, which means from the same womb, or
mm-hmm.
It seems to me that would add strength to it, except for, I mean, I know Israel all came from the same womb, so it was common that they would call each other brother, but it seems like some of the arguments that they use aren't really that strong, especially when mother, brother, and sister was actually used in context as a direct family.
It's the perpetual virginity of Mary, of course, is what you're talking about, another Marian doctrine. It's not really my concern to disprove the perpetual virginity of Mary, but you're right. I think the scriptures in many ways seem to deny the perpetual virginity of Mary, and what the Roman Catholics and by the way, Orthodox do as well, is that they basically find ways to explain those scriptures, I would say, to explain them away. I mean, when it says in Matthew chapter 1 that Joseph did not have sex with Mary until she brought forth her firstborn son, well, it refers to Jesus as her firstborn son, which implies there were more, and Joseph didn't have sex with her until then, would imply that he did afterwards. But the Roman Catholics say, well, it doesn't have to mean that. And perhaps they are right. Perhaps it doesn't have to mean that, but that certainly is the most natural meaning of it. And likewise, when they say, is this not Mary's son, and are not his brothers James and Joseph and Judas and Simon, and are not his sisters with us too? It sounds like it's talking about a nuclear family. The Catholics would say, well, it could just mean relatives, not siblings, and that's true, it could. But again, the most natural reading of these passages, if you have no axe to grind, and if you have no agenda to prove something to the contrary, you would certainly get the impression with these passages that Mary had other children and that she was not a perpetual virgin. Sam, my lines are full and I don't have much time left.
All right.
Okay.
Okay.
Good talking to you.
Yes, you too.
Bye now. Okay, we're going to talk next to Dane, who's calling from Somerset, Pennsylvania. Also, our friend John from Portland. I assume it's our friend John the Orthodox, probably calling about Mary. So I'll try to get to you too, John, before we're done. Dane, thanks for calling. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hey, Steve. I appreciate taking the time to answer my call. I just have a question I'm going to actually ask and get off the line here. Regarding John 5:25, I was kind of comparing some of the arguments against a two-stage second coming versus a single event. And one of C.I. Schofield's arguments is, I believe, that the hour mentioned in verse 25 might be a very long period, because in verse 28 he compares the hour there in verse 28 to two events. Verse 25 could be a very long hour, because I think he assumes it's throughout the church age. Therefore, in verse 28 and 29, when it talks about two resurrections, it could be a very long period of time. Do you understand that question?
I understand the question. I can rephrase it probably.
Oh, okay. Great. I'm going to get off the line and I'll look on the internet then.
Okay, Dane.
Peace, brother.
God bless you. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye now. Okay, here's the question here. There's two references to an hour, the word hour is used two different times of different things, it would seem, in John chapter 5. In John chapter 5, verse 28, it says, "Do not marvel at this, for the hour is coming in which all who are in the graves will hear his voice." And verse 29 says, "And they will come forth, those who have done good to the resurrection of life, those who have done evil to the resurrection of condemnation." Now, here we have an hour in which all the dead will be raised, the good and the bad. Now, Schofield, who Dane referred to in his notes, believed that the good will be resurrected at one time and the bad at another time. Now, this passage speaks of both of it happening in an hour. The hour is coming when all the dead will come out and come forth those who have done good to eternal life, those who have done evil to eternal condemnation. Now, according to Schofield's theory, which is dispensationalism, the righteous will be raised at the rapture before the tribulation. Then, after the tribulation, there's a 1,000-year millennium, and after that, the wicked will be raised. So you have a 1,007 years gap between the resurrection of the righteous and a resurrection of the wicked in the dispensational scheme which Schofield Bible presents. So Schofield sees here a problem to his theology. Jesus said the dead are all going to be raised in 1 hour, the good and the bad. But Schofield says no, the good at one time and the bad over 1,000 years later. So what Schofield is saying is the word hour doesn't have to be literal. It could mean a very, very long time. How do we determine that? Well, go back to verse 25. Jesus said, most assuredly I say to you, the hour is coming and now is when the dead will hear the voice of the Son of God and those who hear will live. Now, he's talking about people being converted. And if he said the hour is coming when this will happen, Schofield says, well, this is the whole church age. During the whole church age, 2,000 years long, is this hour when the dead are the spiritually dead are hearing the voice of the Son of God and coming to life. Therefore, if the hour in verse 25 could be the whole age of the church, 2,000 years, then the hour in verse 28, when all the dead come forth, could be spread out over 1,000 years. So he says. I disagree, however. I believe that what Jesus is saying in verse 25, when he says the hour is coming, he's referring to the same hour that verse 28 is talking about, when the dead shall hear the voice of the Son of God and live. But then he also, in verse 25, he adds a phrase, and now is. And what he means by that, I think, is in one sense, this is a future event that will happen in a future hour, at the hour of the resurrection. But in another sense, it's already happening. And that would be in a spiritual sense. People who are spiritually dead are already hearing the voice of the Son of Man and spiritually coming to life. They are being regenerated. So that Jesus would be saying, there is an hour coming, an hour of resurrection. He tells more detail about it in verses 28 and 29, but it's the same hour he's referring to in verse 25. It is not the whole church age. It is an hour, a point in time when the resurrection of all people occurs. But he also says, as sort of an aside, and now is, that is, this fact is not only true of an hour that is to come, it is also true in another sense of right now. Right now there are dead people, spiritually dead, hearing the Son of Man's voice and coming to life. So what will happen in that hour, the last day, has its, in a sense, a precursor in what's happening now. There's a spiritual coming to life of people who hear Christ now, but the hour is coming when physically this will happen. All who are in the graves will hear his voice. The bodies are in the graves. So I think Schofield is stretching, and he's stretching in an hour to be, over 1,000 years long. That's quite a stretch. And I think it's a desperate one. I think the passage does not require what he's saying. I hope that helps, Dane. I only have a few minutes left. I want to talk to John from Portland. John, I saw your name come up on the board as soon as I mentioned those Marian doctrines. I thought you want to have the last word.
Well, I don't know about the last word, but I did want to maybe comment. It's good talking to you. I haven't spoken to you in a while.
It's been a while. Yeah, good to hear from you again.
I have to say, it seems to me that coming up with a lot of the theology and doctrine behind the rapture is a lot more convoluted, arbitrary, and non-biblical than Catholic or Orthodox doctrine about Mary.
I'd say it's about the same.
Nonetheless, I did want to point out a couple of things to you, I guess.
Sure.
Speaking from the Orthodox side of things, I'll always let our Catholic brothers speak for themselves as best they can. But the point was, in the Orthodox tradition, we do have certain doctrines, I guess, relating to Mary. But they are only doctrines in the sense that they are the immediate consequence of the primary doctrine relating to Christ. You know, he is God, he is fully man, for instance, is a doctrine of our church. Something that you would, and Catholics would as well, I'm sure, no doubt, accept.
Right.
So the immediate consequence of that is if Christ's divinity and his humanity is fully united in some mystical way that we don't even have to explain but simply accept. What that means in a very real way is that Mary is the mother of God. If Jesus Christ, the man walking on this planet, was God, then that means that Mary is the mother of God. Now, you can jump to conclusions going any number of ways, you know, but in essence, that would be a true statement.
I follow, but I've always disagreed with that reasoning. And I know it sounds reasonable, but I'll tell you why, if you want. I mean, I'll be glad to tell you why I disagree.
Well, let me make one other quick point.
Okay.
The difference between the Orthodox Church and the Catholic Church in that anything relating to Mary in terms of our faith is, again, a direct consequence of what we think and believe and teach about Christ. The Catholic Church has done things with some of their doctrines relating to Mary that has no bearing upon how we understand or worship Christ. It's some of their doctrines, for instance, the Immaculate Conception, that has no real bearing upon Christ himself directly.
Yeah. I personally agree. I think they would disagree. I think they would say that if there's not an Immaculate Conception, then Mary had a sinful nature, and Jesus therefore came through a sinful person and must have, you know, somehow been tainted that way. But I wouldn't agree with that. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Okay, I just wanted to say something about the God-man, Mother of God title. To say, well, Jesus is God, Mary was his mother, so she's the mother of God, is not stating the truth comprehensively. And I think what is left out is it can be misleading. Because although it is true that Jesus is God, Jesus is not only God, he's also man. And so, therefore, he's a God-man. Now, if we say Mary is the mother of God, well, we only know of one God, and that's the Father and, you know, the Son and the Holy Spirit. And she's not the mother of all of them. She's the mother of the God-man. And therefore, you know, she is has a very exalted privilege in being the mother of the God-man, the only God-man that ever lived. But her contribution to that was, I believe, human DNA. I think that God contributed the divine nature.
Absolutely.
So I mean, in a sense, of course, Mary is the mother of God insofar as we say Jesus is God.
I think it's valuable to point out that certainly the Orthodox Church makes that distinction very clear. It's not simply she's the mother of God, make of that what you will. The Church has a very clear understanding of what that means, much in line with what you just said.
All right. Hey, well, it's good to be in agreement with you, brother. And the music's playing. I got to run.
God bless you, Steve.
God bless you, John. We'll talk again, I trust.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. I have one announcement I did not make, and I should, for those who live in the Santa Cruz area or in Central California coast, anywhere. We have our monthly meeting in Santa Cruz. It's in a home. It's an open Bible discussion. It's for our listeners. If you're listening, you're a listener, and you can come. Information about that meeting can be found at our website. It's this Saturday. Only happens once a month. This Saturday night, 7 o'clock. There's a phone number, a contact number at the website. The website is www.thenarrowpath.com. And you find that information at the link that says announcements. I'll give you the phone number now, but if you can't write it down or remember it now, you can go find it at the website. The number is 831 area code 475-8301 for directions to that meeting Saturday night. You can find that at the website, and you can find many things at the website. Our mailing address, you can find many free resources. Nothing for sale will be found there. That's one thing you can't find there. It's thenarrowpath.com. If you'd like to contribute to the support of this ministry, you can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. That address can also be found at our website, which is thenarrowpath.com. Till tomorrow, this is Steve Gregg saying thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate those who called. Tune in again tomorrow. We'll continue our discussion.